Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a letter signed by 70 top intelligence officials in support of the former head of the CIA, who had his security clearance revoked by Trump, with others on Trump's enemies list soon to have their clearances yanked too. One of the signatories, Kent Harrington, a former senior CIA analyst who was National Intelligence Officer for East Asia and a chief of station in Asia, joins us to discuss the damage Trump's petty and petulant act of trying to silence his critics does to the country by politicizing who gets a security clearance depending upon their loyalty to the boss, who can kill the messenger's career if he does not like the message. With the president continually pushing the boundaries of the law and political norms by tampering with the Manafort jury as they deliberate in the hope of forcing a mistrial, we will analyze the extent to which we are all becoming inured to Trump's bad behavior with outrage fatigue. And with the former head of the CIA, John Brennan, warning that Trump is, quote, drunk with power, we will explore what can be done to constrain this besieged and volatile commander-in-chief from going rogue and starting a wag-the-dog war. Then we'll assess what reaction there might be within the military and intelligence community to the letter to Trump from the former SEAL and head of Joint Special Operations Command, Admiral McRaven, who led the operation to kill Osama bin Laden. He issued the challenge to our bonespur president, quote, I would consider it an honor if you would revoke my security clearance as well, so I can add my name to the list of men and women who have spoken up against your presidency. One of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal, Robert Baer, joins us to discuss whether the heads of America's intelligence who briefed Trump on January the 6th, 2017, about Russian active measures against the 2016 campaign, who Trump is trying to silence, will eventually speak out if Mueller's investigation is shut down. Then finally, we will speak with Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. The author of Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals, he joins us to discuss what the compromat Brennan suspects Putin has on Trump might be, and whether Putin will meddle in the November elections with cyber mischief to cause chaos at the polls and prevent the Democrats from winning the House and proceeding with the impeachment of Trump. And joining us now is Kent Harrington, a former senior CIA analyst who was National Intelligence Officer for East Asia and Chief of Station in Asia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kent Harrington.
Thank you, Ian. Nice to talk with you again.
Well, thanks, Ken. And you were among the 70 signatories of a letter. Initially, 13 former heads of U.S. intelligence agencies signed a letter. And basically, the letter said, you don't have to agree with what John Brennan says. And again, not all of us do, to agree with his right to say it, subject to his obligation to protect classified information. We have never before seen the approval or removal of security clearances used as a political tool, as was done in this case. So I guess that's at the heart of it, right? Is it not, Kent?
Well, it is, Ian, and I, for one, certainly can subscribe to the statement that in my quarter-century career at CIA, the revocation of clearances always followed a clear and explicit set of guidelines that are not subject to enormous interpretation and did not include, and I'm quite sure to this day, don't include the political views or perspectives of an employee or a government official who speaks out on issues in a retired status, as John Brennan did.
But if Trump goes after Bruce Orr, who's a current employee of the Justice Department, if you lose your security clearance, you effectively lose your job, don't you?
Well, I'm not familiar with what Mr. Orr does for a living at the Justice Department, but certainly if he's involved in any way, shape, or form with national security information or investigations, that I believe would be right. The chilling effect of Trump's commentary is something that I think needs to be talked about separate and distinct from whatever may be debated or argued with regard to his presidential powers. There's no question the president can act under law and administrative regulation to remove clearances. Whether his actions are defensible if they do not find support in the law and regulations that give him that power is a question for lawyers to argue. And I gather John Brennan, based on news reporting today, may well go to court to test that very question. But when it comes to serving government officials at all levels, there is, needless to say, at least two ways in which this action will affect them. Number one, overtly, if they're working in highly sensitive areas that have become political or politicized, they're going to have questions about what they can or can't do that are going to complicate their task, especially if it's one that bears directly on the political issues that are on the front page, so to speak. But number two is just simply human beings who have mortgages, car loans, families, tuition to pay, and all that. It doesn't take a great stretch of imagination to see that when the head of the government, who does have exceptional powers if he chooses to exercise them, speaks out in the way President Trump has, it can have an enormously chilling and inhibiting effect on people who, quite understandably, can worry worry about their jobs if they find themselves in these positions where their work can come under that kind of extra-legal, politicized scrutiny.
But won't this have the effect of people being wary of speaking truth to power? If you're in a situation which is the one that Trump is creating by politicizing the security clearances, particularly if it's done depending upon your loyalty to the commander-in-chief, who can kill the messenger's career if he doesn't like the message. I mean, that's, to me, is really where it's heading, and that's where it's most dangerous.
It's a risk, indeed. And I can speculate based, again, on my career and the opportunity I had to work with a variety of other people on what were at the time issues that were politically controversial up on the Hill, debated in Congress as foreign policy initiatives are often debated and intelligence questions come before committees that have different views on how they should be handled, that it is not infrequent that one finds oneself as an intelligence analyst or an intelligence officer in the midst of a political fray. But the fact of the matter is that, at least when it comes to my experience with intelligence analysts in general, they're a pretty feisty lot. And so the first thing I would say, and I hope this hasn't changed since my departure those many years ago from CIA and the intelligence community, I hope very much that same feistiness, that same contrariness when it comes to presenting the views that they have derived from looking at all sorts of intelligence or from delivering information from sensitive sources that may be controversial for those who receive it, I hope that they continue to do exactly what you've just referred to, speak truth to power, and I'm confident, quite frankly, based on experience, that they will. That having been said, and quite logically, there is no question that in big organizations where there is a chain of command and where people are going to look at issues as they move forward, for example, testimony that goes to Capitol Hill, intelligence reports that represent the view of the agency, not of the individuals that write them when that final stamp of approval goes on, there will be layers of review and approval and oversight that could well reflect the kind of effect that you're describing. So, yes, it's a risk. Yes, this is not an administration that is presenting an image that welcomes different, diverse, and contending views. And yes, this is a president who, by violating norms and maybe even the rules, regulations, and laws that underpin his powers, is sending exactly the wrong message to the people that he needs in order to understand a very complicated and dangerous world.
And then, of course, you've got the in the broader landscape, the unreality of it all, where today on Meet the Press, the moderator said to Giuliani, Trump's TV lawyer, wait a minute, truth is truth. To which Giuliani replied, no, it isn't truth. Truth isn't truth. So again, I'm speaking with Kent Harrington, a former senior CIA analyst who was National Intelligence Officer for East Asia and Chief of Station in Asia. The one thing, though, that I think, obviously a lot of, even Richard Burr, the chair of the Republican chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, he came out critical of Brennan. And what the conservatives and the Trumpsters are critical of is the idea that Brennan used the word treasonous. He actually said nothing short of treasonous. He was pressed on that in an interview on MSNBC with Rachel Maddow. And interesting enough, when she pressed him on what he said, he actually ended up essentially saying, yeah, he did commit treason. And specifically, what Brennan said was, look, I on January the 6th of 2017, just before Trump was inaugurated, me and the heads of all the top intelligence heads in this country, we briefed Trump on Russian active measures. We gave him deep analysis and evidence. He knows that the Russians interfered. Yet, after his secret meeting with Putin in Helsinki, before the eyes of the entire world on in the press conference, when asked about Russian interference, Trump said he didn't really believe it. And he essentially gave Putin a free pass, whereas any commander-in-chief, any American president would have said no. Yes, he did interfere, turning to Putin, looking him in the eye and said, and he must never do it again, or if he does, then he'll have whatever to pay. So that is how a normal president would have. Now, we know that the next day, Trump tried to correct it by saying, "I wouldn't see why he would have." And he said, "I meant to say wouldn't have, not would have." That's like, you know, my dog ate my homework. I mean, that's ridiculous. So, do you think that what happened in that press conference in Helsinki amounts to treason?
Well, let me begin by doing something that I think most analysts probably all are still initially trained to do, and that's to separate facts from analysis. The facts of the news conference that has become so notorious are quite astonishing. What the president said, how he said it, the way in which he responded to questions that frankly, could have been answered much as your hypothetical response a moment ago would have answered them. The correct path, shall we say, for a president in that setting was clear. What Trump did was really quite amazing. The post news conference explanations can only most charitably be described as speaking in tongues. There's really no sense in the word salad that came out of the White House. So the mere facts surrounding that press conference, I think, make quite clear that what John Brennan said publicly, what has appeared in the news about Trump's briefings, what we know from the Obama administration officials who, even during the transition period, went to lengths to describe what they knew already from the intelligence community about Russian interference, leave no doubt that the president was well aware of the facts, whether he remembered or understood them and all of that is another question, but he was well aware of the facts before he ever got off the plane in Finland. The behavior that he displayed, however, is only one of an increasing number of examples of a person who is terribly uncomfortable with addressing Russian policy, our Russian relationship, the challenge Putin and his regime represents to American security head on. So my observation about Helsinki is very simple, and that is this is one more example of why we as a country need to take extraordinarily seriously the risk that is now becoming more and more obvious, that Russian intrusions into our political system are far more extensive, have, for whatever combination of reasons, been more effective, and put at risk more clearly than ever before the political process on which we base the way in which we run our government, protect ourselves, and try to work toward a better future. This president needs to address that head on. He hasn't. It is quite clear he appears not to want to. And the only way we're going to force this issue to a conclusion is to let the investigations that are underway present the facts on both Russian interference in our elections and what, if anything, the evidence points toward with respect to the Trump campaign and its Russian ties. After that, it's up to our political leadership and to the court system to decide. But right now, I would simply say that the Finland experience is probably in kind of Klieg-like fashion, the brightest example of the dangers we face. And it's way past due time for our national leader to acknowledge them.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Putin showed up at the wedding of Austria's foreign minister on Saturday with a Cossack choir. And what's troubling about what's going on in Austria is that the real power behind the chancellor, this handsome young fellow that basically got elected on his good looks, Sebastian Kurz, Heinz Christian Strache, the leader of the far-right Freedom Party, who's, for all intents and purposes, a neo-Nazi, the foreign minister is his protege. Strache traveled to Moscow and signed a cooperation agreement with Putin's United Russia Party, and he's been lobbying, the only Western European leader to lobby for the getting rid of the sanctions against Russia. My understanding is that Western intelligence heads no longer trust the Austrian intelligence service because Strache is purging it of, pro-Western analysts and stacking it with, pro-Russian goons.
Well, your description of Austrian events should be troubling to anyone who thinks about our position in Europe and how it's deteriorated over the last nearly 2 years now under this administration. It also is a situation, and you've laid out the details very well, I think, that should be one we look at closely as Americans, concerned about the politicization of our own intelligence services, most obviously as a reflection of what the president just did with the former CIA director's clearances and its implications, its message, so to speak, for those who work in the intelligence world, but also because I think it would be naive for us to think that with this administration, what Trump has just done with respect to John Brennan and what he may do in the future based on what White House officials have said are sitting on his desk, and that is executive orders for more revocations of security clearances for senior officials ranging from deputy attorney generals to former directors of national intelligence portend. The next steps that the administration might take, obviously, are strictly things that we speculate about, but we can speculate about. But there are also things that, if we look abroad, we can find analogs, we may find parallels, and your mention of Austria is a very good case in point. In addition to what's happened as a result of the rise to power of the far right in Austria and its control of the government, several months ago, in February in particular, the Austrian Internal Security Service, which has worked over the years, whatever its strengths and weaknesses, to monitor both far-right and neo-Nazi movements that could threaten stability in the country, but also to keep track of of Russian and other hostile intelligence services operations, political as well as espionage related in Austria. That internal intelligence service was raided by the police under the direction of the Interior Ministry based on a warrant that, then and in the aftermath of the raid, Austrians of all political stripes have called flimsy at the very best. The Austrian internal the Austrian Interior Ministry, which ordered the police raid with the warrant in hand, is under the control of the far-right Freedom Party, which was given that portfolio as part of the coalition government. And the results of the raid have essentially crippled, if not shut down, the internal security service in Austria. The police that raided the headquarters and the homes of internal security service officials literally scarfed up bags, the plastic bags full of documents, records, hard drives, almost everything that amounted to the documentation on the operations that were being run and had been run by the Austrian internal service. For a variety of reasons that may have predated the raid, some European and other services may well have been skeptical of dealing with the Austrian services across the board. But in this case, the raid itself has caused the Internal Security Service to literally be shut down. And by all newspaper accounts I've seen, European services that were cooperating on a variety of cases have basically turned off the tap when it comes to sharing information with the Austrians. What's the implication? What's the importance of understanding how Austrian events are tending? Well, it's a good example of what happens when governments come to power that ignore both the written rules and the unwritten rules that govern how the laws apply to intelligence services and the body politic. Politicizing intelligence in Austria, the same as politicizing intelligence in the United States, not only has consequences for the agency, but has consequences for the security of the country. Is Austria better off because its internal security service is literally immobilized and shut down as a result of this raid? Well, if you think about everything from Islamic extremism, which the far right claims to be the greatest threat facing its country, to just the intrusions of, say, the Russian GRU or the Russian FSB, the Russian security services, which have an interest in, shall we say, influencing as well as gaining information from within Austria, you have a perfect example of the consequences of what happens when political leaders, for their own internal political purposes and gain, attack the security service, as has been the case in Austria. Think about it for what could happen next in the United States. Washington is not Vienna. American politics is an Austrian politics. But the fact of the matter is we're walking down a path now with this administration. Even if the first steps are incidental, it seems, only applying to one person, Speaker John Brennan, or only applying to one or two agencies. Trump has literally lambasted every government agency involved with security in the United States. The fact of the matter is that steps we've never taken, and we need to worry, and we need to pay attention, and we need to look abroad to see just where these things could lead.
Well, Kent Harrington, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, it's my pleasure, Ian. It's an important subject.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Kent Harrington. He's a former senior CIA analyst who was National Intelligence Officer for East Asia and Chief of Station in Asia. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into whether the heads of American intelligence who briefed Trump on January the 6th of 2017 about Russia's active measures against the 2016 campaign, who Trump is trying to silence, will eventually speak out if Mueller's investigation is shut down. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masterson. This is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Thanks, Ian.
And what did you make of the well, actually, let me ask you about the example that Kent Harrington just gave about how the far-right neo-Nazi Freedom Party, led by Strache, who's the interior minister, basically shut down Austrian intelligence, scooped up all of the documentation, including stuff that the heads had at their home. And you know that that stuff all ended up with Putin, who, by the way, showed up on Saturday to celebrate the wedding of Strache's protege, the foreign minister.
Well, Ian, of course, this is another new precedent that's been broken since Trump came in. You can't blame it on Trump, but the fact is Austria, like Italy in a way, is drifting to the far right and supported by the KGB and Vladimir Putin. I mean, it's clearly he goes to the wedding in your face. We are here. Europe is coming apart, the Atlantic Alliance. Now, he's appealing to Russians, not necessarily the West, but he does feel victorious, especially after Helsinki. You know, the world is changing very, very fast. And frankly, I've worked with the Austrians before. I had never thought this would ever come. I mean, the fact that the Freedom Party, it was founded by ex-SS officers, is not a good sign.
So what do you think in terms of the introduction that I just gave to you, that I find it more than coincidental that Trump is going after all of the heads of American intelligence who briefed him on January the 6th of 2017 about Russia's active measures against the 2016 campaign. And it's clear now that he's trying to silence Brennan. He's going to go after Clapper. And he's also obviously already gone after Comey. They obviously are constrained to say what they know. They told him everything. He doesn't. For whatever reasons, he doesn't want to believe what he was told. And he had an opportunity in front of the eyes of the world when he was standing next to Putin at Helsinki, and he chickened out for whatever reasons. And you're welcome to speculate on why he did that. But it's an outrage that the President of the United States has given Putin a pass now on what he did in 2016. And my sense is that it opens up the possibility that Putin could meddle in the November elections and take away the Democratic blue wave and prevent the impeachment of Trump.
Well, first of all, Putin, what he wants to do most is cause political disruption in this country, which he's managed to do. He hasn't bothered, for instance, just to completely deny that he interfered in the elections. I mean, you know, this Agalarov tape, the music video tape of Trump depicting Trump sitting on the bed with two women dancing on the bed, that was proved by the KGB. It's part of their disruption plan. Or the fact that the first KGB officer to meet Putin and invite him to Moscow in 87, she wrote a letter directly after the election. So over and over again, what Putin cares about is disruption and weakening this country. Now, what he actually has on Trump may be as simple as blackmail related to hotel deals, whether it's in Baku, Toronto, or Soho. Trump, all of the people, his partners in those deals, have connections to the KGB. It's well established. It's been established for years. They were Russian mobsters that reported back to the KGB in Moscow. And I don't think that's a fact that's disputed by anybody. So, I mean, what sort of blackmail they have on him or not doesn't really matter, because all Putin needs to do is dismantle the Atlantic Alliance and NATO. And that's his plan, and get us to back out of places like the Ukraine and sort of give up. He needs an isolationist America, and, you know, exploiting our fault lines, whether it's racism or politics, and he's done a brilliant job at it.
I mean, I think the fact is we have to admit that the KGB has won the Cold War, starting to look that way, the Cold War 2.0.
And here we were after the first Cold War ended, dancing in the end zone, and they've come back to bite us.
Oh, an amazing way. Don't ever underestimate the Russians. They're brilliant. I've worked with the KGB, I've worked with the Russians, and I have nothing but respect for them. And they have their national interests, and they are pursuing them, and we've made big mistakes in terms of, you know, expanding NATO and the rest of it. Mistakes in the fact that we misinterpreted what their reaction would be. Whether it was a mistake or not, that's something else. But the fact is the KGB in 1991 never went away. They simply regrouped. They monopolized energy exports, took that money for political sabotage in Europe and the United States.
And Russia is effectively a KGB state today.
It's always been a Czechist state. It's always been. It's a KGB state. You don't get invited to Moscow if you have any sort of political significance without being passing through the KGB. You don't send large amounts of capital overseas without getting a green light from the Kremlin and the KGB. It's a mercantile state. And, you know, you're right. We danced in the end zone. I mean, we all did. I mean, my bosses, I remember getting a cable. I was overseas. And they said, all right, we don't spy on Russians anymore. If a KGB colonel knocks on the door and volunteers turn him away, you do not have the money to even buy him a cup of coffee. We're not going to authorize it. Turn off all your tell taps. Ignore the Russian mob. We don't deal with them. They're unimportant. It's a Russian problem. FBI, New York City, closed down as well. It's not a problem. They handed off the Russian cases they were following, FCI, the group there, and gave them to the Italian mob guys who didn't speak Russian, didn't know what was going on. So we just figured the Cold War was won. And in the meantime, Vladimir Putin, a lot of other hardcore insiders rule the place.
Well, the difference, though, Bob, is that under the communists, they had an ideology. Under Putin, they don't have an ideology except kleptocracy, theft, thuggery. It's a dangerous combination of national security and organized crime.
Organized crime is what got us, though. I mean, they established a beachhead in 1974 with the Jackson-Vanik Amendment. It was about Jewish immigration, but they emptied the prisons, and then they sent KGB informants to New York. They set up shop in Brighton Beach, Miami, and, you know.
And in Israel, too.
In Israel.
Yeah.
I talked to the Israeli intelligence services and the police, and they said our biggest problem here is Russian organized crime. More important, more dangerous than Hezbollah or Hamas. I've got a police chief on camera saying that.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. So back to, I want to ask you about Admiral McRaven's letter, you know, to our bones per president. I would consider it an honor if you could revoke my security clearance as well so I can add my name to the list of men and women who have spoken up against your presidency. Do you think that's going to resonate within the ranks of the military and the intelligence community?
Well, the military is pretty much, it goes by the book. The commander-in-chief, whoever it is, whether you like him or dislike him, you salute and say, yes, sir. That's one of the problems in the military. McRaven is being accused inside the military of wanting to run on the Democratic ticket for 2020. I have no idea whether that's true or not, but that's what I'm hearing. You know, yeah, it will resonate. And it will resonate that Gates, the former Secretary of Defense, signed this letter as well against the president. And on and on and on. But remember, Petraeus, the rest of them, George Tenet, William Webster, the rest of them are not names known in the heartland. And people in the heartland tend to look at the intelligence community as part of the deep state. It's obviously oversimplistic. I mean, it's sort of like in the 50s that the people looked at the State Department as communist. It's crazy, but these people vote, and they're still energized, and that's why Donald Trump has 42% approval rating.
So when McRaven finishes his letter by saying, if you think for a moment that your McCarthy-era tactics will suppress the voices of criticism, you are sadly mistaken. The criticism will continue until you become the leader we prayed you would be. So you don't buy that. You think Trump's actually on pretty solid ground. He's got a kind of cult-like following. It's pretty hard to – they're kind of impermeable to evidence. So I don't know what you do about that.
Well, you know, going after Brennan, he's intensely disliked by a lot of people because he's so public by the Republican Party. The real question is, and I've been talking to the Department of Justice, is if they pull the clear – this is just would be outrageous on Robert Mueller, which the president could do.
All of his investigators would lose their security clearance, and that would shut down the Mueller probe.
That would shut it down. He would, you know, come up with some pretext that they've misused classified information, that they're not – I can't depend upon them. The president has the authority to pull that. And a lot of what Mueller is doing is based on top secret intelligence. I mean, the fact that they had the dates and times that the GRU hacked the DNC – that's not coming from human sources. So, you know, without that backing, without those solid facts, Mueller, I don't know. What do you do at that point? And will Trump do that? I mean, that would be a huge, huge move. I just can't tell you where it goes next. But he's clearly terrified of what Brennan has on him, what Clapper has on him, and, of course, Mueller. And he can either, you know, let this continue, let it come out that there was a conspiracy between Russian intelligence and the Trump campaign and lose the presidency, or fight today to shut this investigation down. I mean, you have to put yourself in his mind, and he's clearly scared. Otherwise, he would not be going on and on about Mueller.
Sure. And you also, to understand the craven, despicable behavior of the Republicans, if you put yourself in their shoes, are they going to go public and say, whoops, we made a mistake, at the head of our party is a criminal and a con man, and he's owned by Putin? They're not about to admit that kind of mistake. They want a kind of hope to ride this out until November before the proverbial fan is hit.
Oh, absolutely. They're terrified of him. I'm sure that, you know, none of them like what's going on with Trump. But the fact that the base, the voting base, can do a lot of damage to them, and they know it, and they're keeping their fingers crossed things don't get worse. Well, and I see a slide toward fascism, frankly. I mean, it gets worse by the day. There was no cause to take away Brennan's clearance. I don't agree with an intelligence chief out there taking point on this. I'd rather see politicians taking point. But there was no cause, and the bureaucracy, the national security bureaucracy, saying who's next? Do you go after pensions? Do you take clearances away because the way people vote inside the, you know, among federal employees? It could go anywhere from here.
Right. Well, you're no big fan of Brennan. I understand you feel that he wrecked the director of operations.
Ian, don't trust me on that. But I was an operator, but I just don't like the way it turned out. And so I'm no fan. This isn't a personality contest. It's people that are genuinely worried. And when you get McRaven and Petraeus to support Brennan, it's because of principles.
Well, just in closing, is there any? I mean, my sense is that if they shut down Mueller, then Brennan and Clapper and Comey, etc., they will go public. They'll take the risk, will they not? I mean, what do you think of exposing classified material?
It's top secret. It's against the law. It's a felony. they can't.
Well, could they leak it anonymously? Could it appear in the Washington Post and the New York Times and you know, at least to get this stuff out? Because Trump's determined not to have the public find out who he is and what he's done.
It could. I just don't know. It's a personal choice. There is no deep state. There's no organization on this. It's how offended people are that have access to this. And secondly, you would actually need the paper to make it totally convincing. I mean, a lot of it's already come out, like Flynn talking to the Russian ambassador. That would normally be considered top secret, a telephone intercept, but that's been leaked out. What more there is, I have no idea. But it could be very damaging to Trump, and Trump knows it's out there somewhere, and that's why he's terrified.
But just in closing, do you think, I mean, I know it's a guess, do you think Trump, because he seems to be unhinged, as the title of the book goes, and getting more and more desperate, do you think he's going to pull off this gambit and revoke the security clearances of Mueller and his team of investigators and effectively shut down the probe?
You know, he doesn't show any signs of throwing in the towel. So he can either fire Mueller, fire Sessions, Rosenstein, and claim they are, and he's already made the case that they're biased. You know, it's 50-50. I guess he might. Good possibility he will.
Well, Robert Baer, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into what compromat Brennan suspects Putin has on Trump. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Councils under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And I don't know where to begin. It's just an extraordinary moment. Of course, it gets more extraordinary. The idea that the President of the United States is guilty of jury tampering, you know, while the Manafort jury is deliberating, he goes public and basically says, Manafort's a great guy, and this is a terrible thing that's happening, and you know, it's just so wrong. And he's getting a raw deal. You know, one of those jurors is likely to be a Trump supporter, and there you have a mistrial. And I'm sure that's what Trump was going for. In any other era that I can think of, Roger, wouldn't, you know, if a judge or a lawyer had done that, they'd be held to pay. But if a president did this, wouldn't they be screaming from the rafters?
Well, absolutely. You may remember that Richard Nixon was guilty of that a couple of times, and had to publicly apologize. Donald Trump, as we know, is living on and by the margins here, both in electoral terms and political terms. In the long run, he only needs one jury. You're quite right. A hung jury would be an enormous victory for him and would allow him to carry on with this campaign against the inquiry, against Mueller. And I think he's calculating probably day to day what that margin will support, what he can get away with. I do think there is the possibility that he has crossed a kind of red line. This is a more subtle context, I think, than the red lines we usually refer to in the McRaven letter and the revocation of the Brennan clearance. I think that does have an enormous impact. If gradual and if relatively invisible, an enormous impact on the attitude and mentality, not only of the civilian bureaucracy, but also of the military. I think Bob Baer is quite right. There is a salute the commander in chief attitude there in the military. Thank God, up to a point. But I do think they obviously also have their internal politics, their ambitions. There isn't a single senior officer in either the military or the political world in Washington who isn't to some extent threatened by what's happened here, and who knows that under the right circumstances and perhaps unavoidable circumstances for them, they could become a victim too. And I think that's a very insidious factor working against Trump and diluting his authority through the ranks. Now, that's a very gradual process. It doesn't go to the question of whether he will do something quite radical and precipitating a constitutional crisis with the withdrawal of the Mueller team's clearances.
Well, every day Trump and his cronies, who he's put in charge of the VA, they're looting the VA. I mean, it's just a big cash cow for Trump and his cronies to loot. So the vets are all going to get screwed. So at some point or other, one would assume that the reality, what Trump does on a daily basis, and of course, throwing out these distractions on a daily basis, and he does distract people from, in fact, the mendacity of his misrule.
Oh, absolutely. I think, Ian, that's the most damaging and pernicious aspect of the whole thing. How much devastation is being wrought in the body politic? It reminds me of the famous Oliver Wendell Holmes limit on free speech. You're allowed free speech, but you can't cry a fire in a crowded theater. This man is equivalent to crying fire in a crowded theater. With what he's doing with the denial of climate change, the economic and environmental devastation that's already bringing and going to bring, the removal, not just the atrophy, but the out and out removal of protections that have been decades in the making. He's dismantling more of modern American democracy, more of the New Deal, more of the work of the last 60 or 70 years than I think anyone imagined that fateful November night in 2016 when we had trouble believing our eyes and ears. This is going to be the most reactionary, the most destructive American presidency in history, whatever happens with the issue of treason with the Russians. And I think Bob is quite right that Putin is intent on dismantling the West as best he can. I would only add to that, I think, though, that there always has been. You and I have talked about this before. We talked about it even in the summer of 2016 when we were some of the first to discuss the Russian op here. There are divisions in the FSB and in the Kremlin about how far this should go, how much you should alienate the Americans, how much you should encourage or even bring about a genuine American isolationism from Europe. Not all of the trends in Europe that seem to be beneficial to the Russians now in terms of sowing disarray and dissent and all the rest are in the long run Russian interest. The emergence of a series of fascist regimes in Europe might not really be in the Russian interest in the long term. And we're not talking in the old Cold War sense of ideological opponents, but we are talking about a resurgence of nationalism and rivalries and ethnic problems that could really bode ill for coming Russian regimes.
In terms of, I mean, you went to Moscow State University as a Fulbright scholar, I think, Roger, and of course you would have had then contacts with the KGB, that they would have been watching you, etc. So what's your understanding in terms of what Bob Baer was saying about the Russian intelligence services? You say there's some split. My understanding is that the Foreign Service, the SVR, has never been comfortable with Putin's operations against the U.S. elections in 2016. And now I think they're probably debating whether or not to interfere in November. And there's some rumors that Putin and Trump discussed that in their secret meeting in Helsinki. You know, Trump desperately doesn't want to be impeached, so he wants to find a way to defeat the Democrats, and he'll do it by fair means or foul. We know that. So, but you've got Nikolai Petrushev, the National Security Advisor, who's just a lunatic hawk who makes John Bolton seem like a reasonable guy. So
that's right.
Where do you think it stands in terms of the internal debates going on within Russian intelligence? About...
Well, I agree with Bob that one should never, ever underestimate the Russians. They are, for the most part, brilliant. They're by no means infallible. And we have a very voluminous KGB documentary history to show that now from the Soviet era. But like the American government, like the American intelligence community, they do have their divisions. They do have their strong figures in different camps. I think it's an ongoing debate. I really attribute to Putin much more subtlety and refinement in his strategy than many do. I think he's by no means a radical actor in international affairs. He's the run-up to Crimea was very gradual and well orchestrated, and of course keyed to events in Ukraine. Everything that he has done on the periphery to try to salvage the old Soviet glasses, the buffer with the West, has been quite deliberate and very strategic and well executed and successful. We know. How far he goes in really restructuring Europe or meddling in Europe or encouraging instability and political volatility, I think is very much an open question. We must remember that it's in the interests of a kleptocracy, no less than any other oppressive regime, no less than any other tyranny, to have a degree of stability and predictability in the international order and at home as well. And Russia is by no means in good health economically or socially. They've got myriad problems, and Putin faces those at home as well as what he's trying to change abroad. And he has a whole array of new rivals in the world in terms of the emergence of other economic superpowers, not least the Chinese, but Europe in its economic manifestation and the Pacific Rim, and a myriad of problems there that he has to cope with as well. So we're not facing an absolutely indomitable enemy or adversary. We're not facing one that is free of its own divisions or its own debate. We are facing a very formidable and highly intelligent and purposeful enemy. There's no question about that. So, and I think there's no question, Ian. Let's just cut to the chase here. There's no question that Donald Trump is a compromised American president, the first in history. Whether, as Brennan says, it's tantamount to treason, I think is no longer debatable. It certainly is tantamount to treason. He's been compromised in a number of ways. Whether Mueller has the paper trail to show all of the suborning of Donald Trump in financial terms over the years, whether the American investigation has yielded a part of or all of the infamous Moscow hotel tape, whether they have exact and supportable proof of complicity during the campaign, we have yet to see. In any case, whether they do or don't, Donald Trump's strategy here is quite plain. He's going to discredit and try to undermine the legitimacy of the Mueller investigation as best he can, so that he turns this into a matter of legal evidence or of documentary proof, but of a political contest between what he regards as a revolutionary rebellion on the part of the Trump core and the establishment and the old state, deep state, thin state, whatever it is.
Right.
So I think we're headed for a political confrontation in November, which if the Democrats do not win and win decisively, is going to create even more of a crisis for the next 2 years before the presidential election. This is the darkest moment. I've said this to you before, the darkest moment in American political history. I think it really is arguably worse than the American Civil War.
Well, just in the last minute, Putin, of course, after celebrating in Austria the fact that he now owns the Austrian government and they've wrecked their intelligence service and gotten all their secrets, he moves on to meet with Merkel. And essentially what he's saying to Merkel is, look, me and Assad dumped all those Syrian refugees on you, over a million. It's causing tremendous social unrest in Germany and throughout Western Europe. If you don't give us money to reconstruct Syria, because basically, you know, to the victor goes the spoils, we should be making the Iranians and the Russians pay for the reconstruction of Syria. But instead, Putin is now shaking down
right.
Merkel, saying,
right.
If you don't give us the money to reconstruct Syria, you're not going to be able to send those refugees back. And we'll dump more on Europe.
Yeah, this is an absolutely a perfect example of how skillful he's been. It really reminds me, I mean, going to Merkel, it's rather ironic. He's really quite Bismarckian in his approach. This is a accumulating the chips on the table and playing them.
Well, Roger, sorry to interrupt, but we're way out of time here, and let's continue the conversation. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I'll be speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the United States Foreign Service and the senior staff of the National Security Council under President Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon. His latest book is about a comparative history of the inner politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. I'd like to thank producers Ricky Herrera and Kathleen Ash. This program's available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.